Good morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickard, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. With the Iowa caucuses only a day away, grumblings are growing in strength over the power of Iowa in the presidential race, and of course, on the heels of that, the power of New Hampshire. They're two relatively small states with relatively homogeneous populations. So how democratic can they be, wonder critics? Should Iowa and New Hampshire step aside and let other states have the spotlight? Or is there something to be said for the tradition and their unique forms of the democratic process, particularly in Iowa? Join us with your comments on that topic this hour. What do you think? Should Iowa and New Hampshire get out of the way and let other states get in line? Let other states be first? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Our guest this morning is Dennis Riley. He's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. Dennis Riley, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, you're very welcome. I always enjoy it.
Well, according to a national survey conducted for the AP and Yahoo News, just over half of all voters said New Hampshire and Iowa have an extraordinary amount of influence over who wins the two parties' nominations. How unusual do you think that sentiment is?
Oh, I think it's probably pretty widespread because I think it's pretty much demonstrable that their influence is a lot greater right now than it's going to be come November, where they will have only a minimal impact, probably, on the outcome of the general election. But right now, they have an impact on nominations in both parties.
I want to ask you quick about your phone line. I'm getting a weird sort of sci-fi gurgle. Do you hear that? Are you on a landline?
I am on a landline, and I don't hear it.
You are. Well, maybe we'll see how it sounds to other folks. We'll keep it
now. Okay.
Maybe give you a call back at the break. So you said this has been going on for a long time. And can you sort of summarize what people's gripes are with Iowa and New Hampshire?
Well, sure. I mean, the complaint is not so much based on the fact that unrepresentative states are first. It's that we, in fact, as a nation, treat what happens in those two states as definitive. And we really don't, but we think we do. You know, we think that the winner in Iowa and the winner or New Hampshire always wins the nomination, and it's just simply not the case. Sometimes the person from Iowa can't win New Hampshire and fades, as Dick Kephart did in 1988, as George Bush Sr. did in 1980. He beat Ronald Reagan all over the place in Iowa and then got beaten in New Hampshire and ended up as the vice president. Bob Dole couldn't win, won in Iowa in '88, couldn't win after that. So, I mean, we think of it as really outsized when, in fact, it's actually probably smaller than that. But each cycle, it has gotten so much more attention. The Iowa caucuses and then the New Hampshire primary have gotten so much more attention. And the fact that now they're telescoped into a less than a week really changes the name of the game. I mean, way back when I started in this business, the one was in January, the other was in March. So there was a long stretch in between. Nobody even knew Iowa did Iowans caucused until Jimmy Carter in 1976. Nobody paid any attention to them. So it's not so much that they're first, although obviously that's what makes them important. If they were fourth and fifth, no one would even know where they were on the map anymore. So it's a combination of conflating those two questions. Who's first, and what are we going to make of the results in the first places? And it appears that we think we're going to make a lot of the results, even though we don't always.
Well, what do you think that Iowa and New Hampshire have to say to critics who say that these are small states, and in the case of Iowa, it takes a couple of hours commitment in the evening at a very specific time to vote? How do they respond to that?
Well, I think for the most part, they both respond in the same way, and they respond that in a couple of ways. That one, these places are small enough, compact enough, although Iowa is a pretty good-sized state, but still compact enough that candidates can spend a lot of time talking directly with small numbers of voters. You can go into a diner. You can go to a cattle auction. You can go to all these things and talk to real voters. And so they make the retail politics argument that here's a chance for real voters to meet these candidates in a kind of more human setting than the standard rally, or a more human setting, especially than the standard television commercial. So they claim they have that. Plus, you will hear from Iowa and New Hampshire voters sometimes, and especially from Iowa and New Hampshire political leadership sometimes, that these are people who take the responsibility very seriously. and they go to these things, and they're deeply involved, and they pay more attention. And I don't know if I buy that argument, but I know they make it.
Well, as I was reading in research for the show, turnout is pretty low, about 6% of voters last time around, I think.
Well, yeah, it's especially you push into the first week in January, people are busy, it's colder than the devil, and it's a long time, and you got to go there, and you got to stay there. If you really want to have your voice count, you got to stay there for a while. I can go vote at the fire station, four blocks from my house, and go the other two blocks to campus and be teaching. So, I mean, that takes me, 5 minutes out of my way. And that's not like going to a caucus where I've got to go in, because I've done that when I lived in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a different experience when you have to be in there and you talk it all out with people and you stay in somebody's living room, sometimes until close to midnight before you can all settle on what you're going to do. And that's just a whole different kind of time commitment, and fewer people are willing to make it.
Well, in Iowa, too, you have to go stand in the corner with other people, so this pretty much puts the kibosh on having a private
exactly.
vote there.
Not a secret ballot in any right. sense. But, I mean, Iowans are so convinced that they are doing things, they're doing things on behalf of the whole country. They're sifting and winnowing and all that other kind of agricultural stuff. And I'm not so sure that if Wisconsin weren't first, we would take it seriously, quote unquote, and make the same arguments that they make if we were first. But we're not first.
Well,
historically, this is one of those things that people forget. Until about the last two or three cycles, a lot of people didn't want to be first. They wanted to be in that crucial April, May time when we'd be down to the top three candidates in each party, and now we'll you guys got rid of the silly ones at the end, but now we're going to take care of them.
Well, I suppose that's changed a lot, though, because
it
now the first ones are the important ones.
They have become the truly important ones, but at until really the 1970s, even probably more the 1980s, the first ones really weren't the crucial ones.
Well, do you think that the grumblings, the people who are advocating for that to change, is that something that could be, if not easily done, do you think there's a chance in heck of that being accomplished, or is that kind of something that's going to be really hard to pull off?
Well, it's pretty hard to see how you can tell New Hampshire that it must change its state law, because its state law says we're going to have the first primary. And as long as the Secretary of State is willing to do as he did this year and say, I'm not even going to print the ballots until we decide, but we'll let you know. We'll let you know. If we have to, we'll do it the year before. Whatever. But we're going to be first. Well, how do you change a state law unless you're in that state? I don't think a federal court would throw it out.
Right.
States have way too much control over the election process as it is, and it's very unlikely that they would throw it out. So basically, you'd have to convince New Hampshireites to take themselves out of first place, and I think they have a pretty good case when they say, if we're out of first place, we're pretty much out of the game.
What about Iowa?
Well, I don't know exactly how, those are even dicier in the sense that that's not even done by state law. That's done by what the parties do. The two political parties make those decisions. When are we going to get together? This is a meeting that we have, When are we going to get together?
Right.
Whenever we want.
And I read that they had, this was on the actual Iowa site, that they had a deal with New Hampshire that Iowa would be first and New Hampshire would be second.
Yeah. And they'll, now this year, as I said earlier, this is so telescoped. I mean, 5 days from now, they're going to do that 5 days from tomorrow, then New Hampshire goes to the polls and votes in their primary. I mean, it's never been that close together. And I think probably one of the reason it's so exciting, exacerbating, whatever you want to call it, this year, so many states tried to deflect this, and they discovered they can't. They moved to February, they moved to January, and it was like that old scene from the movie Holiday Inn where the turkey keeps jumping back and forth from one Thursday to another to try to avoid being chopped off. No, they weren't able to stop it.
And they created a logjam.
They did. And what I'm wondering, and I have been from the beginning, particularly on the Democratic side, if we have three strong candidates coming out, and then, they will be one, two, and three, but it may not make much difference. When will they start dropping out? I don't see Hillary Clinton quitting if she loses those first two. She's got a lot of money. This is, you know, much more for her than for Obama. This is her shot. If she doesn't get the nomination this time, I don't think she'll get it. So I think she's going to say, hey, I've got the money, I've got the talent, I'm going to stay in this thing until after the 5th of February, and I'm going to slug it out in every one of those states. And what happens then? Because the 5th has got 20 states, I think it is.
Right.
I think it's 20 states voting for the 5th, including California and New York and all kinds of places like that. And so she's not going to quit, because I don't think quit's in her anyway, or she probably would have quit a long time ago at a lot of things, but it's just not in her. She's a determined person. I don't think Barack Obama has any desire to drop out.
No, he's been saying the same thing that you just said. Hillary is saying that this is his one shot. You know, this is it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, I don't think he wants to drop out. I don't know if John Edwards wants to drop out, because this is his last hurrah, without much question, even though he's young. I mean, I don't think he'll be back if he doesn't get the nomination this time around. So it's really one of those things where I think it'd be really hard to shove one of those three out of the race until the bigger states have voted on the 5th.
How about the Republicans?
That's another question altogether. I've seen an awful lot of commentary that suggests that Rudy Giuliani made a huge tactical error by kind of letting things slide in the first two states, even the first three, and putting so much emphasis on Florida and then on the bigger states to come on the 5th, that he should have at least made a better showing in these places, and that he could be so far behind Mitt Romney by that point, it might be just something he can't handle. On the other hand, Mike Huckabee then may do him a favor by beating Romney in Iowa. I don't think Huckabee is going to be the Republican nominee.
That's what the blogs, well, at least some of the blogs, of course, everyone's got their own opinion, but some I read on the New York Times, a kind of conglomeration of what's going on in the blogosphere, saying that he might win Iowa, but that's probably it.
I think it is. He may run very well in South Carolina. I really don't know, although South Carolina Republican politics is so vicious that if some people don't want him to win, it will get pretty ugly. I mean, the things that were done to John McCain in 2000 are just legendary in Republican circles, the kind of negative campaigning that was run against John McCain. So it's likely he may do well in South Carolina because there's, again, a strong evangelical Christian presence, but he doesn't seem to have a strong constituency outside of that. And so I'm not sure where he goes, and I think a lot of traditional Republicans would be very uncomfortable with him winning. I know Andrew Sullivan, the former editor of the New Republic, conservative Catholic, but also a gay man, said on his blog the other night, I hope Huckabee wins the nomination because that's the only way the Republicans are going to be beaten so badly they'll come to their senses. Well, I don't know. Maybe he's right about that. I don't think they will nominate Huckabee. I mean, do they want a guy who identifies himself as a Christian candidate, in a sense, Christian leader, and then talks about abolishing the income tax in favor of a 27% national sales tax? I'm not sure they want to go there.
Well, just to recap what we've been talking about, the weight of Iowa and New Hampshire, and it sounds as though what you're saying is these states may be first, but because, at least certainly in the Democratic camp, we have candidates who are so committed to staying for the whole run, to staying in the game, that maybe Iowa is not going to be as important as we're looking at it right now.
I think there's a very distinct possibility, and I think on both sides, because I don't think if Mike Huckabee wins, he's going to knock Mitt Romney out of anything. Romney's got a lot of money and a lot of determination, and I think he'll stick with it. It helps Giuliani, I think, a little bit, but other than that, maybe not much of an impact. And I think, again, on the Democratic side especially, those folks are still going to be standing come February 5th and yelling at each other and campaigning hard, because that after that day, then we'll see. And then is when the sorting out takes place, I think, because I don't know that will all go one way on that day. And what happens if all three of them are still standing at the end of that day with states they can point to that they won and that they ran close in other states, and now we start doing the delegate counts, and that could really get interesting.
Could get pretty dramatic.
It could.
We're talking this hour with Dennis Reilly. He's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. We'll be back with him right after this break. And this hour, we're looking at all things Iowa and New Hampshire, in particular, whether they're too important and whether other states should get a shot at being first, maybe next time around. Sounds like that would be hard to pull off. But if it were something that could be done, would you be in favor of letting other states have a shot at going first in the primaries? I'm Veronica Rickert, and if you'd like to join in the conversation this hour, won't you call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When identifying badgers, bats, and bears, it helps to have an expert on hand. After 11 o'clock, Larry Mueller talks about wildlife in Wisconsin with Scott Craven. I'm Veronica Rickert, back with you here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the Iowa caucuses and, of course, the quickly following New Hampshire primary coming up 5 days later. And we're wondering this hour whether Iowa and New Hampshire have gotten too big for their britches, so to speak, whether they're too important in the media and in their weight in the race, whether you think maybe other states should get a shot at going first. The number to call to join in is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And we're talking this hour with Dennis Riley, who is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. And Dennis Riley will take a call now from Jeff calling from Kenosha. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. You've already answered some of my question as to the obstacles for change, but I would do think it's terribly unfair that those two states always get to go first, and I would prefer another system, maybe even a national primary. And what are the obstacles to that, and what can a path be to get there? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay. That's a really hard thing to do because from the founding of the nation, voting has been a state-controlled enterprise. And the only federal regulations on voting are things about campaign finance, but also, you can't deny someone the right to vote because he or she is black, because she is a woman. We have our amendments. If somebody's over 18, you can't deny them the right to vote on that basis. Otherwise, we leave it up to the states. So it's going to be very difficult to organize a movement that would take away that much state power. To say to them, you can't set your own primary date. It's going to be set by the national government. And in effect, even when we get to the presidential election, we're not electing the president. We're picking a set of electors based on an old 18th century model for picking a chief executive. We're picking a set of electors who will then go pick the chief executive. Now, we know that we're actually voting and we're controlling. But, I mean, that's even still in the Constitution. So it would be very hard to do it with simply a national law. It would be very hard to convince the two political parties to do it because even though we call them national parties, they're really holding companies for intensely proud state political organizations. And so it would be hard to convince all of the 50 state Democratic parties to say, okay, we're going to put our names in a hat and they're going to draw. And we're going to have four primaries, based on, 13 states apiece or whatever it comes out to. Not quite. But, that's how we're going to do it. Okay, we're going to have not a national primary, but separate primaries. But they won't be regional. They'll be drawn by lot, or they'll be regional. And then we'll draw from the four regions, we'll draw which goes first and which goes second and which goes to, could you convince the 50 state parties not to do that? And I just really don't know if we could.
It sounds like the states have taken the easiest avenue of recourse they have, which is by moving their own primaries up. What's to stop them from doing a primary a couple days after New Hampshire?
Well, in the Democratic Party, has a rule that denies the seating of delegates elected at a primary not approved by the national party, and the national party has a rule for itself that it won't approve any primaries earlier than such and such a time. Mm-hmm. And they have to change that every year because the dates keep changing. But Florida went ahead and said, well, tough. We're having ours early, and you can not seat our delegates if you want to. And it'll be interesting to see if the national party at the convention goes through with that because it won't matter to the outcome of the nomination. That will have been decided. So do you want to punish the Florida Democratic Party at a time when you need them to turn out the vote because Florida's a, you know. So they'll probably back away from that when the time comes anyway. And so it's just hard to find enforcement mechanisms in a truly federal system where political and very proud people are in charge.
It sounds like this year, this campaign might be kind of a bit of a test just to see what happens when all these primaries are moved up.
It really will be. And I'm just quite, I'm fascinated, obviously, but I'm a little apprehensive about the 5th of February, in part because, you know, all that voting will take place in all those different states. But you and the rest of the political media and me and all kinds of other people then have to make sense out of it. We have to say what actually happened. And it's not as easy as all that to say what actually happened. It's going to be hard enough to say on Friday morning, well, this is what happened in Iowa. Well, what do you mean this is what happened in Iowa? Well, we can give you a set of numbers, but what do those numbers mean? Not much, you know, but they mean something. They probably mean that Dennis Kucinich will eventually say enough's enough. Joe Biden may say, I'll just go back to the Senate and run for Secretary of State, you know, that kind of thing. But otherwise, we don't really know. There are a lot of things will come out of that. There'll be a lot of speculation. Then, bam, 5 days later, we've got new numbers. They'll become the most important numbers. And then what? Sounds and there's still Michigan, South Carolina, and Florida before the 5th of February.
Sounds like we could be getting a sort of statistical indigestion.
We probably will, and that day especially, because it's very hard to sort out 20 different results and say they add up to X, unless one person wins them all, and then it's easy to say what they add up to. But if Hillary Clinton wins 6 or 7 states, at least one really big one, but Barack Obama wins 6 or 7 states and one really big one, and John Edwards holds on and gets 3 states, one of which happens to be California. Probably not a likely scenario, but what if it were? Well, how do you say who won the day? I don't know.
Well, we'll have to see what happens.
But there'll be people getting paid to say that night who won the day. You know, there'll be analysts on every network saying this is what all this means, and it's going to get real interesting when they have to try to do that.
Taking another call now, here is Steve calling from Madison. Hi, Steve, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I called to weigh in and cast my vote. I'd like to see a regional primary or a regional system that rotates around as to who goes first, some kind of balance of, the number of electoral votes, small states, large states put together, something. On a bigger picture, it seems like this is all part of the necessity for campaign reform in finance and in how the vote tallying is done, and so that we get something more representative in our country. And I'll take my answer off, or I'll listen off the air.
All right, thanks, Steve. Dennis Riley?
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, and there's a very important political scientist at the University of Virginia named Larry Sabato, who has proposed a regional system with rotation, just as Steve was talking about a moment ago. And, if you could convince those fiercely independent 50 state parties to buy into it, I happen to think, having read a lot of Sabato's stuff, that would be a dramatically improved way of making the nomination. We still might end up nominating exactly the same people, but I think it would be a better way to do it. Now, you have to always remember, if you construct a regional primary in the western part of the United States, you're having a California primary and a bunch of small dances, because, you know, California is the huge prize. I mean, there's 50-some electoral votes there, and you got to get pretty far east before you can add all the other states up and come to 50.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you'd either have to have one huge one, you know, where you go way up to the Midwest in order to pull that off, or I don't know what else you do, because it's just so big relative to all of its neighbors and all of the rest of the region. When you get back to the east, there are larger states close together, in the southeast and the northeast both, and even the upper Midwest. But I don't know, how do we get a regional primary that's about the same number of electoral votes? That would require us to go pretty far south too, I think. So it becomes an interesting business, how you would design the regions. But again, in the end, I think it's still going to be a superior way to go about organizing things. It may knock out some truly underfunded candidacies. It might make those hard to pull off. It probably would prevent Mike Huckabee from being quite the star that he is at the moment. Because he doesn't have the stuff to be in 10 states at once, making the same amount of noise that he can make in Iowa.
Steve was talking about campaign reform, and you had been talking about the logjam created by the other states who are trying to get in on the action
right.
of these early primaries. If there is some sort of huge debacle where it does become sort of hard to tell what's what, would that be the stick needed to sort of galvanize that kind of reform?
Well, it might, or it might just reinforce everybody's feelings that, you know, let the free-for-all go. It did work because we ended up not deciding it with Iowa and New Hampshire, but we decided it on a day when two-thirds of the nation got to vote and so on and so forth. Some people will argue that. Other people will just say, look, as soon as we have two nominees, everybody's going to forget about this nonsense till 3 years from now anyway, so let's just calm down. And we've got a presidential election to run here, so let's just stop arguing about the question of how we ought to nominate them. We've got the nominees. Let's go. And this is a unique presidential election year, too, with so much excitement likely to be generated, because we are at a point, I think it's one of the reasons there's so much focus on Iowa and New Hampshire right now. People are at the point where they want to turn the page. They want a new president. Even some of the people that support him want a new president. They want to start over. Let's get going. And this election is when we get a new one. And that's important. And so we're focusing so hard on it. And we don't have any idea who it is, really, because we don't have a vice president, you know, sitting vice president with a shot at it. We don't have an incumbent president running. So, you know, we're really in an interesting position in that sense. And so there's so much focus on it that I'm betting that once we get two nominees clearly affiliated, it'll be back to the academics talking about this kind of stuff.
Okay, and back to the phones. Here is Zach in Green Bay. Hi, Zach. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that I would be in favor of a system whereby the first few individual state primaries are rotated. However, I did want to make the point that I feel it's important that the primary process begins with a succession of individual primaries, because the trend that we are seeing with Super Tuesdays and large clumps of large states all within 1 week only favors money in the process and those with money influencing the process. And I think that's why it's a good thing that you have a New Hampshire, an Iowa, where less moneyed candidates have a chance to gain momentum. There are far too many trends in the political process that favor the power of money over the process.
Thanks for that call, Zach. And Dennis Riley?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I don't know that we can take it quite as far out as Zach did, but it's still a very good point that we have to keep in mind. The more states on any given day, the more it's got to be done on television. The more it's got to be done on television, the more money you've got to have to do it. And so it does, again, emphasize this sort of thing. Now, 30 years ago, a little over 30 years ago, the myth of Iowa and New Hampshire, that is, that these are states where you don't have to have any money, you don't have to have any organization, you just have to have a candidacy, and you get... That was true for George McGovern in New Hampshire, and it was true for Jimmy Carter in Iowa. But it really hasn't been all that true since. You can't knock a well-funded candidacy off its feet in Iowa or New Hampshire, which is why I really think that you could beat Hillary twice and it isn't over, any more than it's over for Barack Obama if he, quote, loses twice. I'm not even sure it's over for Rudy Giuliani if he loses twice, but he's going to lose bigger, so maybe it will be over. I don't know. But the point is, money really is playing the kind of role that Zach is talking about, and we at least reduce it a little. I don't think we reduce it as much as we did in the 70s and early 80s when you could go in one of those states with very little and make a real showing. But you can still do something, because Mike Huckabee went in there without very much, and with one constituency you can drive yourself fairly far up.
Well, and speaking of beating Hillary twice, I'm sure you've seen the latest polls from, I think, this morning or last night. I don't know how much stock you put in polls, but they are saying that Barack Obama has pulled ahead by above the margin of error.
Right.
I think he's at 32 and Hillary's 26, something like that.
Right, right. Although, boy, were there people crying foul.
Right, right.
But I don't know, you know, I don't know exactly on what basis they're crying foul. I read a little bit about it, but it seems that they're very unhappy with the methodology of the Des Moines newspaper. Was the Register, wasn't it?
The Register.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That they were unhappy with the methodology because they thought it was putting too many independents into the pool of people likely to caucus with Democrats. And it did have a higher number than usual, but independents are not going to caucus with the Republicans this time. I mean, I think independents will caucus with the Democrats if they go at all, because the Republican stuff doesn't look all that interesting to them, I don't think. I don't think they really want to be involved in making that choice. But they'd like to be heard on the choice of Obama, Clinton, and Edwards.
Well, whether or not the polling was on the up and up in terms of including the independents in that, there is the huge argument about wanting to be with the winning horse. And they are the certainly, I think, the Hillary Clinton camp is saying that was not a good thing. People want to back a winner, and if it seems like Obama is going to win, he's going to draw more votes.
I think that's possible, though I suspect that would be a lot more convincing argument in a primary than in a caucus. Because in a primary, you know, you just have that one quick thing you got to do. You can do it on the way home, or do it on the way to work, whatever. You can do it on your lunch hour. You make that one quick thing. You go in, as you pointed out earlier, you go and you do that one by yourself. But a caucus, you don't do by yourself. There's a whole lot of other people there. So I think the bandwagon mentality probably is a little less convincing an argument in a caucus setting. But it never helps a candidate to have an opponent said to be ahead beyond the margin of error in the survey a couple of days before the action, whatever the action is. So I know why they were upset.
We're talking this hour with Dennis Riley. He is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. We're talking about the Iowa caucuses coming in tomorrow, whether Iowa and New Hampshire have too much weight in the political process, and also sort of just what's going on there on the ground in Iowa. Hope you'll call in with your questions and your comments here on the eve of the Iowa caucuses, and you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. That's the number here in Madison where we're broadcasting today, so the number is different than the usual Milwaukee number. I'm Veronica Riggert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 12:30 on Chapter a Day, Susan Sweeney reads from Cage of Stars, a novel by Jacqueline Michard. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Iowa caucus this hour, whether Iowa and New Hampshire have too much weight in the process, and what to expect after the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary. Talking with Dennis Riley, he's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. And we'll go to the phones now and take a call from John in Racine. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Good morning, Veronica.
Morning.
Good morning, Professor.
Morning.
The current cycle in this election process just indicates how badly the power of organized labor has diminished and how it's been destroyed by the political apparatus in this country. We certainly remember 2000 when five people's vote counted more than anyone else's in Bush v. Gore. We've had 35 years of abominable labor policy. No one has really, in Iowa, put a microphone in front of any of the Republican candidates, certainly none of the Democratic candidates, to say what your labor policy is going to be for the dislocated workers in this country. And one day there is going to be a tremendous combustion because of the poverty and the despair in this country that the factory closings have caused. And it's amazing that hasn't occurred up to this point. But we have been marginalized in the political process, and for those of us in organized labor, the best alternative is a third-party candidate in November.
Okay, thank you for that call, John. And Dennis Riley, do you think that organized labor has had a voice in these elections?
Well, you kind of have to divide organized labor these days into two very distinct sets of people. Organized labor in the private sector, I think, has been marginalized. Maybe I don't think quite as much as John, but it has been marginalized dramatically. And the National Labor Relations Board over the last 8 years has made a series of decisions that have contributed to that. But mostly it's just that, you know, unions no longer have the strength in the private sector workplace. But then there's public sector unions, teachers unions, and firefighters unions, and police officers unions that are still a fairly powerful force. Certainly an awful lot of people that I hear talking think that WEAC, the Wisconsin Education Council, is way too powerful in the Democratic Party and way too powerful in the political process. And certainly Governor Tommy Thompson thought that for 12 years or however long he was there, 14, I guess. So, you know, the unions per se may not have been marginalized. Private sector unions clearly have been. And I think that their influence in the Democratic Party is probably at its lowest ebb. I think John may be right about that.
All right. Thank you for that call, John. And taking a call now from Willem in Colfax. Welcome, Willem. You're on the air.
Hi. I agree with a lot of what John, the previous caller, said. But I think the part that bothers me is that they're always the discussion is always about the horse race, you know, the political inside stuff that is covered by the major networks, which isn't surprising because they've been more and more concentrated, fewer and fewer voices, and we hear fewer voices of the people running, and rarely is it, what's the difference between the candidates' political positions other than the fact that, you know, they wear their hair this way or they say this or that, but I think it turns off the voters. I mean, if you can only get 6% of the people to come out to these caucuses and you get people lining up at 4 in the morning to get the cheapest iPod at Walmart. I mean, something is going on in the political process in this country. And there's a quote of Chief Justice Brandeis. He said, we can have a democratic society or we can have the concentration of great wealth in the hands of the few. And we can't have both. And I think that's what's happening with this recent action by the, you know, having people allowed to have TVs and newspapers in the same market is this concentration of media coverage. We get so little, you know. What are these people running on? We never hear about that. And they only cover the top three. And you know, I think it's eroding the political process, and it's a real danger to our democracy.
Okay, thank you, Willem.
Okay.
Wow, there's a lot to chew on in that, that's for sure. The coverage, the horse race mentality coverage, as it's so frequently referred to, is, I suppose, something that we see a lot in the organized mass media. But, you know, in a little bit of defense for them, that's the only thing that changes from one day to the next. How many times do you want to say, how many times do they want to say what John Edwards said about education yesterday? And there's a good chance he didn't say much about education yesterday. There's a good chance he made his stump speech about powerful entrenched interests and how he's defeated them as a lawyer and he'll defeat them as a president. And so, you know, a lot of times the media that cover these people get kind of bored with the substance of things because the substance doesn't change that much from day to day. But what changes is who's up, who's down, and that's something people can relate to. So there's a real problem there in what do you cover and how exactly do you cover it. I'm not entirely in agreement with Willem about the narrowing of the spectrum of media outlets. It's actually been an explosion since I was a kid. When I started teaching political science in the late 1960s, you got Walter Cronkite, you got Huntley and Brinkley, or you got whoever was in the rotating chair at ABC. You want the news? That's what you get. Even NPR was pretty much a fledgling outfit. But by the time I'm here now, there's radio outlets, there's Fox TV, there's CNN, there's all the rest of it. But maybe something he's thinking about there. One of the changes that seems to bring is it's just that much easier for a voter to find the kind of news outlet that will tell him or her what that person wants to hear. You can select the ideology viewpoint of your news media outlet pretty effectively in the United States now. especially when you throw in talk radio and all sorts of other stuff, us excepted, of course.
Well, I suppose you could argue that if the major media stopped covering the horse race mentality quite so much, you know, right now the candidates are, I imagine, tailoring their campaigns to suit that sort of approach to coverage.
Absolutely.
And if the media decided to cover it a different way, the candidates would have to change too. Maybe you would get more substance. Maybe you would have John Edwards kind of riffing on different things from day to day.
You might. I mean, certainly it won't be broken from the candidate side. I mean, we have had candidates that talk mostly substance, and things don't work out quite so well for them sometimes. So they're going to campaign the way they want to campaign, and it's not going to be all substance. And the audiences they're campaigning to don't want all substance. I mean, a lot of the people who show up want to, you know, as they say, want to hear a little red meat. I mean, they want some kind, I suppose you chew on red meat, but want a little action, want a little passion, want somebody to say, I really care about this, and to hit on the big kinds of things. And reporters go to these things day after day and hear the same stuff. But a voter that comes may only see one time. You know, in Iowa they may see each one of them, but maybe only once, maybe twice at the most. And so they hear the same speech that somebody else heard, but it doesn't matter because that's the first time they heard it. So it's really it's hard for the candidates to break out. So the media would have to break it, but then what? What do they cover instead? What do they cover about politics if they're not covering
right.
Who's going to win? You know,
so it's a bit of a death grip right now that nobody's going to break.
Nobody knows. Nobody knows how to get out of this hold.
Well, we'll go on to take a call from Michael in Janesville. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really enjoying the conversation today.
Great.
I just wanted to ask both of you a question about the candidates still involved in both parties' primaries who are not really being talked about a lot. I know that there's a debate happening on ABC this Saturday night, and I understand there's some pretty strict criteria, so we'll only have about four candidates from each party, and it's happening between Iowa and New Hampshire. And I'm wondering what both of you think about sort of the bottom-tier candidates who have been, to a degree, a lot in the public eye for the last batch of months and are now going to start to disappear. Do they still have any potential to impact the conversation at all, or are we literally just going to see them drop out one by one in the next 7 days? What is that conversation going to be like in the next several weeks?
Okay, thanks a lot for those questions, Michael.
Thank you.
And Dennis Riley?
Yeah, again, that's an excellent question Michael poses. The first thing that flew through my mind was that it really does fly in the face of the myth that this is the place where an underfunded, unexpected candidacy can take off, and you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If they're gonna marginalize guys with the stature of Joe Biden and Bill Richardson and Chris Dodd by saying, no, you guys didn't make the cut for the big four. I mean, Richardson might be the fourth, but from your side, wow, that says that you can take your small underfunded candidacy, but it gets one bite at the apple, and it better take a big bite out, or we're just going to take it out of the picture altogether. That's kind of scary, because they do contribute something to the conversation, or at least I think so. I think Dennis Kucinich contributes to the conversation. I don't plan to support him, editorial comment, but I do think he does contribute to the conversation, because he's saying things nobody else is saying. And if this process is supposed to be a conversation, and Michael seems to think it is, and boy, I would sure like to think it's going to be, then hey, let all these voices ring out for a while, okay? Let it go at least till the snow melts. And it doesn't appear that maybe it will go till the snow melts. So that might be the real impact of these states. Not that they pick a winner, but that they throw so many people overboard that we only have a fairly small, and in many respects at this point for the Democrats, a relatively narrow range of choices in terms of public policy issues.
Well, maybe as you're saying, the fact that there is this logjam in the primaries and that it might take us a while to winnow through these would leave these voices in longer and change the shape of the debate.
Well, one would hope so, but I'm getting a little nervous for a lot of them in terms of being able to find the kind of money going back up. John was talking about it. Other kinds of people have talked about it. if they don't have the money to mount a serious effort, and as you said a while ago, there is that feeling that, you know, once your guy is at 2% when people have actually cast their ballots, maybe it's time to find a horse with more legs, and for particularly for politically active people. And so it could be that we'll lose some of these voices that you know, just have to go back to their day jobs, kind of, you know, that they'll just say, okay, enough's enough. It was my shot. I didn't make it. And go home, and their voices will come out of the conversation earlier than it would be good to have it. But I don't know how you stop that, considering that the megaphone for your voice is buckets of dollar bills.
That's a poignant statement. Anyway, we're talking with Dennis Reilly this hour about the Iowa caucuses and what it takes to stay alive there. The Iowa and New Hampshire primaries are close on one another's heels there, and we'll be seeing that shaping up starting tomorrow. You can join in our conversation this hour at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. We have a couple of phone lines open for you. And taking a call now from Rick in Green Bay. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. Given that it looks like we're going to have multiple candidates after Super Tuesday, and it's going to be like 6 months until the conventions happen, what's going to take place in that, you know, that six-month period of time in your mind? And if Michael Bloomberg decides to get into the race, when do you think he'd make a move?
All right. Thanks a lot, Rick. Dennis Reilly.
Wow. When would I think Bloomberg would wait a little bit longer because it will be harder to keep the spotlight. I think his move would have to be somewhere in between. Now, he doesn't want to wait too long because you've got all that stuff about getting on the ballot. We're back to the 50-state federalism business. You got to get on the ballot state by state, and there are strange rules about getting on the presidential ballot. So he'll have to make a move probably, I think, in March or early April in order to be on the ballot in enough states. And he's got a lot of money, and he might even have some support, though I don't know how much support he would have. The really intriguing question for a political science type like myself is, what do we do if we have no nominee coming out of the crunch of February 5th? If the Democrats are still in a slugging match, then what will those Democrats do? Will they look for a way to compromise? Will they look for a way to become a ticket? Or will they really be willing to hit each other every day, 4 months until the convention? And I think that's a really hard question. I think the Republicans may not face it. That is, they may be able to make a decision earlier. The Democrats could face it, and there will be a lot of pressure on Barack Obama, I should guess, but there'd be pressure on Hillary Clinton, too, but more pressure on Barack Obama, I suspect, just to say, okay, I will take the second spot on the ticket. Hillary can't do that, but he could. Or I will, graciously step aside. It depends on how close they are.
Would an independent like Bloomberg shake up that possible future you're talking about?
Oh, I suspect he'd shake up everything, at least for a couple of weeks. I mean, for not just one news cycle, but for several news cycles, he would shake up a lot of things. Because I suspect a lot of folks would say, hey, here's an idea. They might walk away from that idea very soon, but they would walk toward that idea for a little while. I bet he'd look pretty good in the initial polls. Then people would, of course, immediately say, well, who is he taking votes from? You know, is he taking votes from the Democrats or votes from the Republicans? And so we'd have all that speculation, which would keep him in the news. And then, again, you know, you talk about his bucket isn't filled with dollar bills. It's filled with $1,000 bills, and it appears to be, you know, infinite. What did they say? He could spend $500 million of his own money and not know it?
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. I mean, that seems to me like a lot of money.
That's a lot of power right there.
Sure.
A lot of airtime.
Yeah.
Well, I had been hearing that some speculation that he could pull from the Democrats and swing those so-called purple states to the Republicans.
It's a possibility. He either is or was a Republican. I can't remember which. He spent some time in each party. He is from New York City, which I suppose doesn't ride well in some places, but so is Rudy Giuliani. So, I mean, you know, it would be interesting to see a three-way race between two, you know, a mayor of New York, a former mayor of New York, and a senator from New York. I don't know how that plays in the plain states, but It would be interesting.
So, Dennis Reilly, are you looking forward to tomorrow?
I am, as a matter of fact. I'm looking forward, probably more looking forward to reading about it Friday morning than to staying up all the way to the end of it.
So you're not a true junkie. You'll be looking at the paper comfortably the next
morning. Probably looking at the paper. I'll be on morning edition by 5 a.m. That'll get me some.
Oh, that'll get you out of bed.
Some information.
So do you have any, you're not going to go out on a limb and project, but is there anything you're expecting to see tomorrow?
I suppose what I'm expecting to see tomorrow is a Democratic race that's still pretty bunched up. It may be that it'll be, you know, 30-27. So, you know, it might be within 2 or 3 percentage points. But it's the Democratic field is not going to change in any substantial way unless John Edwards trips over something and feels he can't go on. And I don't think that'll happen. So I think you're going to still see 3 pretty strong candidacies head to New Hampshire.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time, but thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Well, thank you. It was fun.
Great hour. Dennis Reilly is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Thank you to Keisha Mabra for on-air production and Cheryl Gasser for producing this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.